Are you an organ donor? Have you ever known anybody who was waiting for an organ on the transplant list? This hour on the Lee Rayburn Show, we are taking a look at xenotransplantation with an organ transplant surgeon and a professor in the surgery department at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Perhaps you have some questions about xenotransplantation, which would be taking animal organs and using them for human health. And we seem to be at the cusp of a medical breakthrough here. According to the new book of our guest, Every Living Creature, How Xenotransplantation Will Change Our Lives. Our guest is Dr. Joshua Mesrich. And you can join our conversation with your questions or your stories at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Dr. Mesrich, welcome back to WPR News.
It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a quote from your book that has stuck with me as I continue to read your book. And you say that xenotransplantation is a story of an innovation so transformative that it will change how we look at what is possible for humankind. You go on to call it a miracle, truly godlike. What's your reason for this, as you call it, xeno-optimism?
Well, I am an optimistic person, but the idea of using animals as sources for human organs has been around for a long time. And I think the modern version of that probably started in the 60s. But it's been a real challenge. And in order for organs from animals, like, say, a pig, to be accepted into a human, there's a requirement for genetic modification, for some changes to those organs so that our immune system wouldn't reject them. And it's only recently that we've gotten so good at genetic modification that we actually can generate and clone these animals where the organs can actually be accepted. And that's such a huge advance. To me, it's like putting a man on the moon. We're at the very early stages, but it's really incredible that we're able to think about doing this.
Dr. Mesrich, when I hear the words genetic modification, I think of CRISPR, because that's what I've seen in the news stories. So is that part of this story of xenotransplantation and the next generation?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I like to think about that innovation happens with hard incremental work, then some quantum advance, then more hard incremental work, then another quantum advance. And if I were to tell the story of Xeno, I would say the first quantum advance was the cloning of Dolly the sheep back in the mid-80s. And that got us to the point where we could actually clone a large animal. And then the second quantum advance, I like to say, is CRISPR. Now, I will say gene editing has been going on really since the 80s, but it was cumbersome and difficult, and there were a lot of off-target effects. We've just gotten so good at it, and CRISPR has made gene editing as easy as, using Word to edit a paper. And I think those two advances are what's making this a reality.
But before we had CRISPR and this genetic modification, your book details all these, and you describe it well as these ebbs and flows, but it's so incremental, the advances in organ transplants. And it's almost hard to believe that we're, what, like more than 70 years past the first successful kidney transplant now? It's been more than 60 years since we started looking at using chimpanzee kidneys for transplants. That's a long time ago, and we've come a long ways since then, but it has been, as you detail in your book, incredibly incremental. There have been a lot of little steps forward to get to what appears to be a brink today.
Yeah, I mean, it's really well said, but I would also say this, like, it's still a blip in time. So I like to remind people the first successful human transplant was 1954 between two identical twins. And we went from transplant being science fiction in the 40s and 50s to becoming a reality, a repeatable, reliable thing, really 1983 with the approval of cyclosporine. So it was from 54 to 83, we went from science fiction to reality and transplant. And we've just been getting incrementally better from the 80s till where we are now. Now, xeno is maybe a little bit bigger step. I think transplanting from a different species into human has required maybe more work than that. So you can take one attitude and say, oh, this 70 years is a long time. I would say that it's really a blip in time when you think about what we're able to achieve. Now, you meant the first efforts were with chimpanzees. And the truth is, in terms of the genetic differences, we probably could successfully have done chimp transplants in humans quite a long time ago. But there are lots of barriers why we no longer consider chimpanzees. And I can certainly go into those. But now everyone is thinking about pigs as donors. And that's more challenging than using chimps.
So yeah, let's go into that, because a lot of this is, there are a number of different animals, and some of the science included testing between different animals and humans eventually. But when it comes to chimpanzees, what is it? Was it a matter of cost or morality? You have a part in your book about Jane Goodall actually talking about these transplants.
Yeah, it's so amazing that Jane Goodall is part of this story. That kind of blew my mind. But the challenge is this. If you look at animals kind of below primates on the evolutionary scale, so we might be talking about pigs, cows, you know, horses, anything like that, those animals all have this sugar on their cells, the alpha-gal molecule. And animals, primates and above, so like old world monkeys and humans, that includes chimpanzees, all have natural antibodies to this sugar. And that probably came about 27 million years ago from a virus that wiped out large animals that didn't have this antibody. And then we've maintained that antibody. So if you take an organ from a pig or a horse and put it into a human, it would be rapidly rejected because of this natural antibody. Now, chimpanzees don't have that sugar on their cells. And so it's much easier to put a chimp organ into a human. But the challenges are the following. Number one, chimpanzees breed like we do. You know, they have they breed over 9 months. They have one baby per time. So the idea of trying to breed chimpanzees to replace human organs would be both expensive, nearly impossible, but also very dystopian and kind of crazy. I think number two, there's a morality issue. Most people are not comfortable with using chimpanzees in that way. And in fact, they're a protected species. They don't breed well in captivity and all of that. Number three, there were, you know, major infectious concerns. People might know that HIV came from chimpanzees, and there are a number of other viruses that are thought to come from that species. And, you know, the reality is people have been comfortable sacrificing pigs for food for so many years. We kill 1.5 billion pigs a year in the world for eating. So there is a morality issue there that there's comfort. And so actually the early efforts with chimpanzees were ultimately met with a lot of protests. People may remember the Baby Faye case in 84, which was actually a baboon, not a chimpanzee, where a heart was placed in a baby, and the protests were massive.
Tell me the story, Dr. Mesrich, about Jane Goodall, because she was invited to one of these xenotransplant conferences. The expectations was that she was going to speak out against it, and it was a much more grayer area for her and her personal experience.
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating. So on the 25th anniversary of the first efforts at xenotransplantation, and those were in 63 and 64, there were some chimpanzee kidneys put into humans. And actually one of them lasted 9 months with very little immunosuppression. But anyways, on the 25th anniversary, which was in 89, they had a big conference with all the luminaries of transplant. And this was in New York, just outside of New York City. And the organizer decided to invite Jane Goodall. And I reached out to him and said, why would you invite her? And he said, I really thought she was part of the story, which I think is really true. So they had this conference and they had all the luminaries talking, and they were presenting the outcomes and the data and the exciting science. And people were really excited about the progress. And the last speaker was Jane Goodall. And Jane Goodall got up and said, I'm not going to talk to you guys about your science. I'm not going to talk to you guys about whether you should or shouldn't be doing this or that. I'm just going to tell you about this family I've been living with for the last 20 years. And it was the family of chimpanzees. And they had names, they had envy, they had love, they had anger. They used tools. They even had stories where some of the chimps saved humans. And she just gave this talk that just really humanized or gave identity to these animals. And at the end of it, everyone in the audience was like, oh my God, we can't do this anymore. I mean, now Jane Goodall had, she wasn't saying at that time we shouldn't be doing animal research. She recognized that, I believe it was her mom had received a heart valve, a cow heart valve. And she recognized that she didn't want research to stop moving forward, but she was very against the idea, you know, that we try and move forward to replace organs with chimpanzees. Now, as she may have felt differently towards the end of her life, and funny, someone interviewed her towards the end of her life and mentioned, I heard you were at this conference with these xenotransplant people, and she said, yeah, I thought those guys were just crazy. That was her. I didn't include that in the book, but yeah, she would have said she really would love for us to work towards figuring out a way to use less and less animals in research, but wasn't at that time saying we should stop all of that.
Dr. Mesrich, Ellen in Madison called but couldn't stay with us. She asks if you can clarify the difference between a body donor and an organ donor. She also asked how limiting is it for a successful organ transplant that donors most often need to pass away in a hospital with healthy organs?
Yeah, I mean, those are really, really good questions. So many people believe in organ donation, but many of us won't die in a way that we can actually donate organs for use in transplants. So probably only 1% of people die that way. And you really need to die in such a way that you make it to the hospital where you're essentially on life support, whether you become brain dead, which means that your organs are still working, but there's no blood flow to your brain, or you get to a point in the hospital where support is going to be withdrawn in sort of a controlled manner. If you have cancer, you're not going to be an organ donor because we don't want to transmit the cancer. There are certain infectious diseases that can make it a challenge for us. And then, of course, your organs need to be working. If you're what we all want, dying in very old age and kind of at the end of life and the organs are no longer functioning, then you won't be able to be a good donor. So it ends up being about 1% of people who die that way. Now, there are other ways to give gifts after you die. She meant, you know, whether it be other tissue, skin, heart valves, or donating your body to science, which can be done for teaching, for experimentation of new devices and things like that. But to give the gift of an actual organ transplant, you need to kind of meet those criteria. If you're to die at home, you know, that might not be a possibility. So those are some thoughts.
Which begins to explain why there is this vast discrepancy between those in need of an organ transplant and the viability of human organs available to do just that. And there are a lot of people on these wait lists for whether it's lungs, heart, kidneys, liver, you name it. But therein lies the opportunity for xenotransplantation. Our guest is Dr. Joshua Mesrich, organ transplant surgeon at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. His new book is Every Living Creature, How Xenotransplantation Will Change Our Lives. His previous book, When Death Becomes Life, Notes from a Transplant Surgeon, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk at WPR.org. So how did we settle on pigs as a viable animal for xenotransplantation, Dr. Mesrich? I see the UW-Madison has a Center for Biomedical Swine Research and Innovation. They call of it the one-of-a-kind, but I see in your book that there are other pig research and innovation stations like this around the country and the world now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question. You might not think, you know, pigs would be the ideal organ, but there are a number of reasons it made sense. Number one, size-wise, pig organs can fit well in humans. That was always a challenge with chimpanzees that I didn't mention. They're actually too small, and a heart would be too small from a chimp. You'd have to use both kidneys. So pigs can be the right size, and particularly a breed of mini swine that are a little bit smaller than the large outbred pigs. So that's number one. Number two, pigs breed very quickly and can breed at a young age. Their estrus cycle is fairly short. They have multiple pigs in the litter from 6 to 12 pigs. So when you're talking about gene editing and cloning, it helps to get a big litter so that you can make sure you have some piglets in that litter that have the gene edits you're interested in, and then they're ready to breed again pretty quickly. I mean, and then in addition, there is this comfort in using pigs as a food source, so I think it raises less ethical concern. And then finally, I'll say that we've been interacting with pigs for more than 10,000 years, and they haven't been a source of a pandemic to this point. So unlike maybe primates or chimpanzees, we're intimately involved with pigs for so long. So from an infectious standpoint, that might be safer. So that's a short list of why pigs make sense.
Let's go back to your calls and questions now for our guest, Dr. Joshua Mesrich. We'll start with TJ in Columbus. Hi, TJ.
Good afternoon. Welcome aboard, Lee. Glad you're here. Thanks. And all those Larry Mueller leaders. Thank you. My question is regarding, and I missed the pretext and everything of what our thing is about here, but I enrolled in the Living Donor Program through UW Health. My mission was to donate a kidney, just be a non-directed donor. And I was disqualified because of some radiation treatment I received for cancer. But the UW Living Donor Program sounds amazing. The voucher system that they have and the potential for covering costs if you incur any and things like that, the outcomes are better. The longevity can be better. And I'm not quite sure that many people in the public even know about it. But the voucher thing where you get the 5 vouchers and you can then give them to people that you care about, and if they are in need in the future, they are somehow prioritized, is amazing. That's amazing. And I shot a competitive trap for years with a fellow that went through receiving a transplant and watched how it changed his life. So it inspired me. And I'm 65 years old with no history in my family, so I can probably fly on one engine from here out. So I just thought it was great. I really was kind of bummed when I no longer, qualified because of the radiation, but it's an awesome program, and I'm not sure many people know.
TJ, thank you so much for sharing it. Dr. Mesrich, from the perspective of a organ transplant surgeon, what does the Living Donor Program mean to you?
Well, gosh, I just want to say bravo to TJ for coming forward and for his awesome words. I am actually the head of our Living Donor Kidney Program as well. So what he's referring, living donors are amazing. All donors are amazing. They're truly heroes to me. And that's what my first book was really focused on. This idea that someone would come forward and say, I know someone's suffering. I know someone's scared. Let me be sick with them and we'll get better together. Let me give a piece of myself. I find that in this crazy world we live in, the thing that reminds me that we actually care about each other and want to help each other, and I love it. What TJ was describing was our paired exchange program. So we work with the National Kidney Registry, or NKR, which is this wonderful organization that's huge and based in New York, and actually was founded by a father whose daughter had kidney failure, and he wanted to donate her a kidney, but they weren't a matched blood type. So he ended up creating this program. So the basic concept is, say you want to give your brother a kidney, but you're not a compatible blood type. Maybe you're B and they're A, but maybe I want to give my sister a kidney and it's the reverse. How about I give your brother a kidney and you give my sister a kidney? That's the short version of it, but it can get much bigger than that. It doesn't just have to be two pairs. On top of that, when you get people like TJ who come forward and say, I just want to donate into the group, I want to help someone in need, you can then help more than one person. Your kidney can start a chain where this non-directed donor gives to someone and their donor gives to someone and their donor gives to someone, or it can just round out a few pairs or something like that. And it can be the catalyst to get multiple people transplanted. The NKR has gotten so big that they've been able to add on these things that just are so wonderful. So, one of the reasons some people say they say, I want to donate, but what if my kid or my grandkid needs a kidney someday? So what they allow is you can say, I'm going to come forward and donate, and then you can name 5 family members. And I'm going to say family members in quotes because you get to define what is your family, and they get vouchers. And if one of those 5 needs a kidney, that NKR will give them a kidney from a non-directed donor in the future. So not only are you giving this gift to save more than one person who needs a kidney right now, but you're giving this incredible get out of jail free for, you know, five family members if they ever need a kidney. And it has allowed us to say to people, if you're interested in donating, don't worry about, people always say, well, I hope I'm a match. Don't worry about that. That doesn't matter. If you're healthy and you want to donate, you know, we'll consider you. It's just beautiful to even step forward for it. And I know it sounds like it didn't work out for TJ for whatever reason, but honestly, that someone would consider doing that, I think, is amazing. And we're just really careful to make sure, number one, that we're not putting a donor at more risk than they realize, or then, you know, and number two, that we're getting a great kidney for our recipients as well.
So, yeah, the donor's health has to be taken into consideration. And it sounded like TJ may have had some pre-existing conditions, but all but the best, all the best intentions in the world. And TJ, thank you for sharing that. We actually have a show about living kidney transplants coming up on Tuesday, August 11th. So we'll be returning to this conversation with Melissa Roberts at the UW Health Transplant Center. So we'll continue with this. And TJ, hopefully you can be along for the ride then as well. You make some predictions at the end of your book, Dr. Mesrich, and one of them is that you believe you will sew a pig kidney into a human as an FDA-approved bridge while the patient waits for a human kidney. How close are you to this at this time?
Yeah, it's always hard making predictions, and especially hard, by the way, writing a book for something that's ongoing is like...
Right. Developing fast.
I know. But so... trials have begun. So we actually have two trials with pig genetically modified pig kidneys going into humans as we speak. One sponsored by a company called United Therapeutics, which is a large pharmaceutical and biomedical company, and one by a company known as eGenesis, which was a spinoff of George Church's work, who's like a genius that we can talk a lot about. But they have actually started enrolling patients, and a small number of patients have received pig kidneys. And we know as of this point, one person, the kidney actually lasted for just under 9 months. And then just as it failed, he was able to get a human kidney. So it actually bridged him to that. Hopefully by 2027, those will turn into multi-center trials. And we're hoping at UW to be a part of that. I'm not making any announcement here, but I'm hopeful that in 2027, you know, we are able to, you know, consider patients in some sort of trial. Now, we don't know what's going to happen, you know, so the outcomes are good enough to be able to get in human trials, but we'll have to carefully evaluate those outcomes to see if they'll receive FDA approval to be used outside of a trial. I don't think the current iteration is ready to say, like, here's your pig kidney and you're good for the next 10 years. I don't think we're quite there yet, because I think we still are learning about the best genetic modifications, what are the best medications we need on top of that to prevent rejection. But I think we are good enough to say this kidney can last 6 months, a year, maybe a little bit longer. And in a patient who's really, really struggling on dialysis, maybe they don't have good access, maybe they just can't tolerate it, it might be an option as a bridge as we try and get a human kidney. And I am hopeful that in the next 5 years, that's a reality. I don't know for sure. I think in the not too distant future, there are iterations now that are going years in primates as the model for humans. And my hope is that in the near future, we're trialing even better products that I can say, this is as good as a human kidney. And even maybe eventually this is even better than a human kidney, you know, but we're not there yet.
Dr. Joshua Mesrich, our guest, organ transplant surgeon and professor in the surgery department at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Looking forward to the day that he gets to sew a pig kidney into a human as an FDA-approved bridge while that patient waits for a human kidney themselves. Perhaps you have a question about this xenotransplantation. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll return to some of the stories and some of the people that are featured in this book next. The book is Every Living Creature. It's out now. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. ¶¶ The new book is Every Living Creature, How Xenotransplantation Will Change Our Lives. Our guest is the author, Dr. Joshua Mesrich, who is also an organ transplant surgeon and professor in the surgery department at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. If you've got questions for our guest on The Lee Rayburn Show, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And I want to get into some of the stories of the people who are featured in this book. But before we go, let's return to your questions and stories. We'll go next to Erica in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, Erica.
Hello there.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention I gave my mom a kidney in 1997 at UW. So we may have met. You were probably, I don't know, 10 years old. But this was right before they started doing it laparoscopically. I got a scar clear from my naughty place to my backbone. It's something you can do for another person, be it a family member or a friend or whatever, and you can live. I'm my kidney numbers, I just had them done not too long ago, and they're just fine.
And this was,
like the guy said before,
30 years ago.
Yeah, it's feels like a lifetime ago to me.
Well, I appreciate you sharing the story and also sharing your kidney, of course, Dr. Mesrich. We talked about that was like 1997, and I think back to your book around that time that xenotransplantation seemed to be taking a huge step backwards with, and this actually has a tie-in to UW-Madison and Fritz Bock, who went on the Fresh Air on NPR with Terry Gross to call for, who was talking about the dangers of xenotransplantation and called for a moratorium. There was also the Diaries of Despair in the year 2000, these arguments against xenotransplantation that seemed to be working against the advancement of the science.
Yeah. So what a great lead. And first of all, thank you for that call. And I love hearing from donors. And it's just beautiful. And you're right. You can donate. And while I will never say it's zero risk, our donors do amazing and live a normal, full life. And so kudos to you. Bravo again. Now, it was an interesting time, 1997, and I wasn't a child. I just finished medical school, so just wanted to throw that in there, I guess. But yeah, some of the story was here. Fritz Bock, who was a brilliant man, a bone marrow transplanter and a researcher, and was like on the short list for the Nobel Prize for some of the science that he did. A lot of it right here. He was here. He was also at Minnesota and at Harvard, but a lot of his work was here. And we have, just so people know, one of the leading transplant centers in the world and have had that for a long time. So that's how I ended up here, because I'm the leading transplant surgeon. No, I'm just kidding. But it's an incredible place to practice. But Fritz Bock is a really fascinating character. He was living in Germany and was a Jewish man and was able to get was brought out on the Kinder transports to England and then ultimately to the United States. So he lived through this totalitarian nation and had his life saved. And I think that plays into some of his decision-making. So in the 90s, there was a lot of excitement about xenotransplantation, and a lot of this was going on in England. It was a man named David White who had done some very early genetic modification of pigs with very rudimentary techniques. And they had a really simple modified pig that clearly was nowhere near working in humans. But David White was so good with PR and publicity and got people really excited. And Novartis, the gigantic pharmaceutical company, dumped what ended up being, you know, $1 billion into xeno. And people started to think, oh, xeno's right around the corner. We're going to have pigs, you know, providing organs right around the corner. And I think three things led to xeno kind of crashing down in the late 90s into early 2000s. And those three things were, number one, well, the outcomes into the primates were not nearly good enough. So it had always been said you needed to get at least 6 months, if not a year, survival of a pig organ into a baboon or a monkey to be able to consider human trials. And they were nowhere near that. So that was number one. The outcomes weren't good enough yet because both the medications and the modifications weren't good enough yet. Number two was concern about infection. So this virus was discovered in the cells of pigs. Now, people might not realize this, but we all have had portions of viruses, their genetics, placed into our own genetics. Some people call that endogenous viruses or like fossil viruses that are in our own genome. And some of those pieces of DNA that are in our genome have actually led to evolutionary advances. Like the reason we can make placentas and do childbirth is actually came from a virus implanting into like early evolutionary pre-human genome. So it's like quite interesting. But it was found that there was this virus in pig cells, sadly named PERV, or porcine endogenous retrovirus, which was in the genome. And even though not that had never led to an infection in humans, there was concern that what if you put an organ in someone, could it cause an infection? And then and just keep in mind, in England, they had just been going through mad cow disease. There was lots of fear, you know, they're showing these young people with this horrible encephalitis and confusion and their lives falling apart. So there was a lot of concern about that. And then the third was like animal rights activists. And interestingly, UK has had very strong history of animal rights activism. And so two things happened. You mentioned Diary of Despair. Well, David White's labs were kind of broken into by a bunch of animal rights activists, and they were able to get journals, and they weren't really diaries, but journals and documentation, and release that into the press that made it look like animals were suffering, weren't being treated well. And that got a ton of press in the UK. And then the third thing was, because of this concern of the virus, even though no infection had been caused in humans, Fritz Bach, who was a leading xenotransplant researcher, actually suddenly came out and said, we need to stop doing xeno research. He had this concern about causing a pandemic, us not knowing what we were doing. And not only did he write an article, but he surprisingly went on to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And you can actually still find that in the archives. And Terry says to Fritz, it's unusual that like a leading researcher is stepping forward and calling on a moratorium, you know, like on Fresh Air. And he said, Terry, you know, I have major concerns that we're moving forward too quickly, and there's no reason for us to assume that we won't unleash a massive virus we've never seen before that will decimate human populations. And that, and he called for a moratorium on the science. And that was very, you know, powerful coming from a guy like Fritz. He's unfortunately died, but his son is actually a very famous physician and researcher, Peter Bach. But Fritz is a complex man, a genius, but a controversial. And I've always wondered that if part of living in this totalitarian state where the government did not protect the people might have been something that led him to push back against trusting that the science and the FDA would protect the people. I don't know that for a fact, but I think it's an interesting thought.
Dr. Mesrich.
Those three things led to xeno kind of going on the back burner from the early 2000s until really 5 years ago.
I was going to say, is part of this story then of the return of xeno optimism, the CRISPR genetic modification ability to, you know, sort of remove the possibility of spreading a virus from xenotransplants?
Yeah. So I think there are a number of things have happened, I guess, in the last, since like probably 2015 till now, 2012 till now. One, we've gotten so good at gene editing, the Human Genome Project, CRISPR gene editing, our ability to do that. Number two, our ability to manage infectious disease, to have treatments for various viruses, including the potential for PERV if it were to happen. We've learned a lot more about PERV and been able to identify that there are versions of it that are very passive and not concerning. So we're able to breed pigs that have this kind of less threatening type of PERV. And then George Church, the kind of brilliant gene editor I've mentioned before, who's at Harvard at the Broad Institute, he actually generated a pig where he used gene editing to cut PERV out of the pig genome. And then he's been able to clone pigs that not only have genetic modifications to make the pigs more acceptable to humans, but they don't have PERV in them anymore. So I think all those things have come together to make us realize the risk of infection from pig is not zero, but it's manageable if done very carefully and correctly.
And George Church was associated with eGenesis, who has a clinical trial ongoing. The other company that you mentioned, which is fascinating to me in your book, Doctor, is United Therapeutics. And one of the stories you tell is not one of a doctor at all, Martine Rothblatt, who is the founder of United Therapeutics. But that story is just a fascinating tale of, and so many of these are folks who identified the need for transplant science to advance and then became part of that advancement as they grew older.
Yeah, I just love this. If I was a movie director and I said, "Can you bring me like three or four characters that are just going to pop off the screen?" I mean, Zeno's got it all. So I do, you know, part of my last book in this book, one of the things I love to write about is pioneers. And I don't think a pioneer is just someone who does something great, but they're people who like want to change the world. And they have this belief, almost a psychotic belief, that they can do it even though no one else has. And I write about, there was a sociologist who said, "Oh, these world changers have the courage to fail." I think they have the courage to fail, but I think they have something more, which is the courage to succeed. They know that even with the failure, they're going to succeed. So we mentioned George Church, who actually my brother is a writer, wrote a book about him, because he's also the guy who is trying to bring the woolly mammoth back. And he has he spun off that company that's, you know, that brought back the dire wolf. And he has a million spinoffs like this. But I describe George Church as he's tall, he's lanky, he has a booming voice, and the person he most resembles is God. Like, he has this big beard. He's like, and now Martine Rothblatt is similarly fascinating. People may know of her. She actually was a student in college, and she was really into space. And she kind of wanted to, you know, go to space, go to Mars. And she actually came up with the idea of using satellites to be able to transmit radio signals. And she started what became Sirius Satellite Radio. And when she did that, like, no one thought that was possible for so many reasons. Only the military was using satellites. That wasn't how radio worked, but she started that. Then, you know, she became unbelievably wealthy, and then her daughter Genesis got sick, and she had this disease, pulmonary hypertension, and there was no treatment for it, and it was like a death sentence. Well, that didn't sit right with Martine. She's like, "No, I don't listen to that." So she sold her shares in Sirius and ultimately started a pharmaceutical company. Within something like 5 years, had the first drug to treat pulmonary hypertension. Saved her daughter's life and made billions of dollars on top of that.
But she didn't stop there.
She didn't stop there. So now she's like, "Well, what if someday my daughter needs a lung transplant?" She was very interested in the Human Genome Project and gene editing. She basically just educated herself on all of this stuff. And she waited until the timing was right, but she got a PhD in the ethics of xenotransplantation, because she said, "I'm not going to be the one to do the science, but I'm going to need to represent as the CEO, like, the ethics of why it's okay to do this." And, you know, now they're one of the leaders, I would say the two or three leaders in making xeno a reality. She is the most confident, impressive person. And I just will mention, she, in the middle of this, went through a transition. She's transgender, and I can talk about this. She wrote a book about it, and it's an incredible, beautiful book talking about, you know, why she did this and why she wants to be a role model for people that are doing this. She's also in the process of putting people's consciousness onto, like, the computer, mind clones.
I was just going to bring this up. Bina, what is it? Bina 48, I believe. Because this is part of the predictions that you wrap up your book Every Living Creature with, is the future of xenotransplantation may not include animals at all. And that appears to be the next steps that Martine Rothblatt is taking.
I mean, this is like sort of like beyond my ability to get my head around. But, you know, I think we all agree that computers and, you know, algorithms in the internet are getting faster and faster, and you're able to interact with chatbots that are more and more lifelike. And this whole question of whether they can jump over to become sentient, like, I'm not going to be the expert to discuss this. I think it is very possible that you would talk to a chatbot and not know that it's not a human, but whether it's actually sentient, I think she would say, yes, it can, you know, it can develop consciousness. But her idea is that none of us ever need to die. We can eventually, you know, take your loved ones and make mind clones. Now, I agree that you could make a mind clone that's like your dad or your mom, and your kids would be able to meet them and not know it wasn't them. But to me, it still wouldn't be them. I think Martine would argue with that, and I'm not the genius that she is, so I'm...
She's not arguing. She's creating it. Bina 48 is her partner.
Bina. So Bina is her spouse, or she calls it her spice, who, you know, they have an incredible, incredible connection. And so they actually have like a humanoid robot that looks like Bina, and it's very advanced sort of chatbot, if you will.
But then there's also the question of whether AI will play a role in organs and whether we can remove xenotransplantation and look at AI transplantation in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think AI will play roles like on many different levels. So like number one, as we think about gene editing and modeling, like we are just at the, someone used this analogy, so I don't take credit. We're like at the flip phone level of Dino. And again, this is one of my partners, David Alfhauser, brought this up. We're at the flip phone where we want to get to the iPhone or whatever. And trying to figure out which gene edits matter, how that's going to respond in a complex system, that's definitely way beyond our abilities. And I think AI is going to play a great role in some of that modeling. I think AI is going to play a great role in helping us to prevent the need for organ transplants in many patients. I'm personally very excited about drugs like the GLPs. A lot of our kidneys and our livers are from diabetes, fatty liver NASH, you know, so maybe we can prevent some of those things, and AI will help us with that. We have so much amazing medical science that's going on right now, and Xeno just happens to be my favorite.
We are at the flip phone point of this, waiting for the smartphone part, which appears to be perhaps right around the corner. Dr. Joshua Mezrich, our guest, organ transplant surgeon and author of his new book, Every Living Creature, How Xenotransplantation Will Change Our Lives. Let's return to your questions and stories for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll go to Jean in Superior next. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share, my son was an organ donor. He died as a result of a pretty horrific car accident. But what I wanted to share is that it was, her whole experience was nothing like what you see on TV or movies. The coordinators that we worked with were just fabulous. The surgery team was just wonderful, so compassionate, so sweet. We were walking him down to the surgery room, singing his favorite lullaby, and he was 21. He wasn't a baby, but we walked right past the surgery rooms. The nurses didn't realize it because they were so enthralled with us. It was just really delightful, but... I heard from his heart recipient a year and a half later. Turned out that he was the top, you know, he was on top of the list to receive a heart on the West Coast. He had Jonathan's heart within, I don't know, I think it was 6 to 8 hours. And then the thing that I found so amazing was that he had an incredible craving for bacon cheeseburgers after the fact.
Is that just
Jonathan's favorite food?
That's amazing.
I thank you so much for sharing that story, Gene, and I am so sorry for your loss. But as I have heard from other recipients of organ transplants, Dr. Mezrich, that this life goes on in that organ, and in this case, with a bacon cheeseburger, quite literally.
Yeah, I mean, Gene, thanks so much, and what a beautiful story. And it's both tragic but also beautiful that, you know, Gene lives on in those ways. And I think, like, the donation process it brings so much hope to the recipients. It also brings a lot to the donor families. It's this beautiful legacy. I've had many donor families say it's what allowed them to keep going. Many become very close to the recipient families. I love this sentiment of like a cellular memory, or this idea that a recipient would take on some characteristics as a donor, of the donor. And as a scientist, I don't know if that's true, but as a human, I absolutely love it. And I have many, many stories, and like just one that comes to mind that I wrote about in my first book, this young woman Michaela, who received a liver, and she was like essentially a vegetarian, didn't really like meat, but she ended up getting a transplant. She didn't know who the donor was. And when she woke up, like all she wanted was a cheeseburger. And it was really weird to her family because she just didn't really like that. Yeah. And so then for months, she wanted to find out about the donor, and she'd written all these letters and didn't hear anything. And then finally, they got a letter and her mom filmed it. They were in the car and Michaela was, you know, the car had stopped and Michaela was reading the letter and she was shaking and reading it and crying. And you can watch the film. And then all of a sudden she screams out, "Oh my gosh, he likes hamburgers." And it was this beautiful idea that this donor saved her life and is living on in her. And by the way, she is so close with the donor's parents. And it gives me goosebumps to talk about these kinds of things. Yeah. And it is the beauty of it.
Gene, thank you so much for your call and sharing your story and the story of Jonathan as well. But as you make clear in Every Living Creature, Dr. Mesrich, just because we don't know yet doesn't mean the connection is not there. And there are people that are still looking for it, and we may someday find that connection between what it is that translates from an organ into somebody's, you know, dietary preferences. Yeah. And Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to ask whether organs are human, or, regardless of whether they're human or xeno, how readily does the DNA of recipients become dominant in the new organs as cells are replaced? Do donated organs take in recipients' DNA? We got a couple minutes to handle that one.
Wow, I mean, that's a complex a question, and I don't know that I know the perfect answer to it. I mean, I think you know, there's probably some cells that get repopulated into a donor organ, but the donor cells still stay there, and the differences in those cells still persist, like for the life of that organ, which does mean that even 15 years after a transplant, if you stop taking immunosuppression, you still will reject that organ.
Oh, wow.
So it doesn't become repopulated in the way that like a scaffold would then just take on all of your own cells. There are scientific projects, you know, going on to try and do things like that, take stem cells and repopulate scaffolds so that you wouldn't face rejection. But in fact, the differences in the donor DNA remain there for the life of that organ. Despite the fact that some, like your immune cells will go in and populate that donor organ, but the sort of parenchyma, the cells of the body of that organ will still stay there. So it's like really, really interesting thing. Like, it's the very rare patient that you can remove immunosuppression. The vast, vast, vast majority, even 20 years out, would reject that organ, even at that point.
Quickly, Dr. Mesrich, Ted emailed to ask you to address the possibility of transplantation to replace cartilage, ligaments, connective tissue damaged by aging or injury. Is that a possibility?
I mean, I personally am hoping for it as I age, so I will say that. I think about transplant, there's like the kind of, if you will, living kind of functioning organs like a heart, a lung, a liver, kidney. Then there's like things like bone grafts or ACL, you know, when you tear your ACL, they'll sometimes take cadaveric or deceased donor ACL. And that can be done. I mean, heart valves are inert and they're taken from either humans or pigs or cows. And those work, but they're sort of like, like a bone. It's not it's not functioning. It's more structural. I think this idea of taking stem cells, either your own stem cells or derived from a stem cell line, and injecting them and having them repopulate is very realistic and very possible. And I think there are some trials for heart injury, you know, your own stem cells, for things like knees. Now, one area I just want to say something, I think the area of type 1 diabetes, which are islet cells, we're having real success in trials taking islets that are derived from stem cells and injecting them and curing type 1 diabetes. And I don't think we're far from like really curing type 1 diabetes. So, I'm an optimist.
Yeah, but I also feel like we're on the cusp of a lot of things medically with some of the recent breakthroughs. But as your book, Every Living Creature, makes clear, it's a lot of incremental advances followed by some great epiphanies, a few steps back, followed by a few steps forward. It's an amazing read, and I thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. That captures it so perfectly. Innovation is hard work, takes time, takes belief, and takes some amazing characters.
Indeed. Dr. Joshua Mesrich, one of them, organ transplant surgeon and professor in the surgery department at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.